Sai Ram, dear listeners, welcome to another segment of Afternoon Satsang. We are continuing the satsang where we left it off last week on the topic, the Golden Quadrilateral. And as always, it is Prem and myself, Arvind from Team Radio Sai, both of us offering our humble pranams at the lotus feet of our dear Bhagwan, praying to him, seeking his inspiration and love as we proceed in this satsang. Before I welcome Prem, I think I will just place before everyone in brief what we had discussed last week. The Golden Quadrilateral has four vertices, like any quadrilateral, each of the vertices being Vyashti, Samashti, Srishti and Parmeshti, the individual, society, nature and God. And the theme along which we are riding is the truth that we cannot look at any of these vertices in isolation. They all have to be seen in unity as one whole. One cannot say that one loves God and ignores society and nature. That is what was emerging from our discussion last week, and here we are to continue it along this week. Sai Ram, Prem.
Sai Ram, Arvind. In a sense, I think it's a gloomy topic to have in an afternoon satsang. But you know, the beauty of spirituality is, I mean, even as you start seeing and reading spiritual books, if something is not practical and it's not pragmatic, it's not worth going after. And that is why spirituality is very, very essential. And that's what Swami has shown us, that it is not something which you wear on Fridays and Sundays or something like that. It's something you use every day of your life. For instance, somebody was giving a very beautiful explanation of what is the meaning of Vedanta. You know, Vedanta means Veda Anta. What is the culmination of the Vedas? And Veda means it's a book of knowledge. That's the actual translation. So any knowledge which is pursued to its ultimate, you know, the culmination, the ultimate, whatever it is meant to lead to, that is Vedanta. And all that Vedanta says is that, look deeper. Bring from within what is not obviously apparent. And I think that is why looking at environment as, you know, people would say, what is the point? Are we going to be able to change anything? We've taken so many hundreds of years to spoil it. Can 10 years of conscious action or 20, 30 years of conscious action bring back anything? But I think that is where the beauty lies. It may be possible to change things. It may not be possible to change things. But what we are trying to do is look at whatever has happened as symptoms and try to see what really went wrong. Can we change that?
And also when you say about we have ruined it over a period of time, we can also look at some of these environmental and societal disasters which have not actually taken place over the past 100 or 200 years.
Right.
Some of them have happened so rapidly over just 10 to 20 years' time. We will see one example like that this week also. So it has happened so fast within 10 to 20 years, and that is inspiring in a sense that if we can ruin something in 10, 20 years, which means with collective effort, it is possible to revive it also in another 10, 20 years.
Very true. I think, so with that introduction, we'll go into what we're talking about today. As we did last time, maybe we'll pick up a couple of cases where indiscriminate action, what it leads to. As you said, it could be quite immediate. It need not be over a period of few decades also. Now imagine you bought a new house, you moved into a new locality, and you're living there for a few years. And one fine day you go into the basement and you find some blue goo-like stuff just bubbling out of your basement.
Oh my God.
You know, something is erupted in your basement and something is coming out, some obnoxious looking chemical which is blue in color. That's exactly what happened in one particular place in the United States called Love Canal. Okay, there is this small suburb, it's a small settlement, where suddenly they found that rocks were exploding with chemicals. They found that it were coming out from the ground in the garden, and as I said, in the basement. And when they went and started researching what had actually happened, it seemed to be one of the most, ridiculous way of waste disposal which had shown up.
Okay, so this is some waste that had been buried there years back.
Right, you know, it all starts way back in sometime in 89. This is actually near the Niagara Falls.
1989?
1989, sorry. 1889.
Okay.
basically there's this person, I think his name was, a person by name Love, that's why it's called Love Canal. Mm-hmm. He comes up with this idea that he wants to build a canal which connects Lake Ontario and the Niagara Falls River. So for commercial purposes and all, but it doesn't come through. He tries for many years. So eventually it becomes a small canal which people use for recreation and all that. And with time, the canal dries up. So now you got a huge canal bed. So what happens is there is this company which is called, I think, Hooker Chemical. Yeah, it's Hooker Chemical. I think they changed their name now. So this company comes by and they buy this huge piece of land because they're having chemical factories and they're producing some kind of waste which they have not figured out a way how to dispose it. So they come up with this idea that they'll put them in these huge barrels, metal barrels, and bury them underground. So they just wanted a huge expansive place, which is away from inhabitation, of course. But still, nevertheless, it's not a very sensible way to get rid of your waste, especially chemical waste. So they buy this huge land and they bury these tons and tons of chemical waste underground.
So under the Love Canal.
Right, under this, what back was the erstwhile Love Canal, you can say. And, this was much later after that. This was in the possession of that company. And one particular school board, you know, they come by and they say, we want to buy this land. And obviously, Hooker Chemicals was not ready to sell the land because they know what is under the ground. In fact, they did mention that this is what we've done with the land, so we cannot give it away because, first of all, there's not going to be any vegetation growing there. So this school board says, no, we want to build a school somewhere and, you know, you would have houses coming up around. And it's been quite a while, so it's safe. So they sold that entire piece of land. I think it should be around close to 100 acres for something like $1 with documentation that this is what the land holds. So we are not responsible for anything that comes up. And can you imagine a suburb comes up in that area? And that is when the disasters which I mentioned came by. And when they researched, I think the US Congress has admitted that this is one of the most indiscriminate act by a firm where no thought has been given about the future generations. Just living without any worry of what you are going to pass on to the next generation.
Oh my God. You know, even as you were narrating this, Prem, I had not heard of this incident before. I was thinking how, first of all, how reckless on the part of this company, Hooker Chemicals that you said,
right,
to bury chemicals like that. And then what was wrong with the management, the board of management of that school that they wanted to purchase that area for building a school? I see, this is what I think happens when we think of a situation in exclusion of any one of these four vertices, that is the, what we said, individual, society, nature and God. Any decision that we take has to take into consideration all the four. You cannot take a decision in isolation, forgetting one of them. When you hear it, when you think deeply or directly, any angle that you look at it, it looks very absurd and ridiculous that first of all somebody could bury chemicals so in such an unsafe manner, and then somebody could actually pick up that to build a school. And naturally, you see, when a school comes up, there is bound to be residential complexes that arise, and to meet the needs of that, there will be grocery stores, supermarkets, everything. It's going to become a settlement there. A settlement sitting on top of a chemical bomb. A nightmare. Definitely a nightmare. What happened further on, I mean, after that?
Yeah, that's what been. That whole thing is abandoned now. Everybody had to vacate, except for a few old people who don't mind continuing to live there because it's so difficult to relocate. It's not easy that you could leave everything and go by. But I think most of them have deserted that whole place. Now it's, I think some of those things have been even pulled out of the, from underground. I mean, it's just nothing can be done because you would have spoiled that entire area soil for, I'm sure, few centuries to come.
Only in name it remains Love, I think. There is absolute barren ground there.
But it's all, as you said, it's a perfect example of not worrying about what is the legacy you're leaving behind. You know, the company, I don't know whether your owner thought that he's going to live for 100 years, and as long as he's able to make enough money in that period of time, or the school board, maybe they were just setting it up and selling it off. You know, you have these startups which start things, and maybe the school board like that. But it is a perfect sign of you not worrying about what you're passing on to people, and it might not affect you directly, but you're not worried about what effect it's going to have on them.
You know, you spoke of this example where the people concerned are not thinking about the future. Sometimes such drastic and dramatic changes happen when you don't think of the past as well. The example that comes to my mind is that of the Dead Sea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let me take you back in time. And when I say back, it's not like 1,000 or 2,000 years. Take you back 3.7 million years. And this was the time when the entire Middle East area, what we know as Middle East today, that
right.
is Israel, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, this whole area was inundated with waters from the Mediterranean Sea, which lies okay. to the northwest of this region. So the waters would come there, there would be floods, and there were huge, like, backwater areas, huge areas covered, inundated with water. That was 3.7 million years ago. Then 2 million years ago, that is when, see, basically what has happened is this, there are some parts on this land which is called as a rift valley. Basically, mm-hmm. a rift valley is a deep depression on land.
Okay.
So, water, whenever it floods, has a tendency to move towards the rift valley. And therefore, whatever lies between the rift valley and the source of water gets flooded.
Okay.
So, there is a rift valley in the Middle East. Then what happened 2 million years ago was, the land between the rift valley and the Mediterranean Sea rose suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And in geological time, when you say suddenly, it's like over 10,000 years.
Right.
Okay. So, but compared to 2 million years, 10,000 years is suddenly. So, suddenly that land rose, because of which the Rift Valley got separated from the Mediterranean Sea. And so, that land in between the Mediterranean Sea and Rift Valley is like a plateau.
Mm-hmm.
And that has formed many of the countries today. And this Rift Valley is today known as, has become two seas. One is the Sea of Galilee. The other is the Dead Sea.
Okay.
Now, why is the Dead Sea called the Dead Sea? Is simply because nothing can live there. Neither plants nor animals, because the salinity is very high. Now, why is the salinity so high? At one time when the Mediterranean Sea used to flood this area, the salinity was normal. But as water evaporates, the salt remains back and the salinity goes on increasing. Now, the River Jordan, it empties first into the Sea of Galilee, and then from the Sea of Galilee it continues further south into the Dead Sea.
Okay.
So the River Jordan is the only source of water to the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea is an endorheic lake, which means there is no outlet of water. It doesn't drain into any other ocean or sea further on, and Dead Sea is a pretty small sea. It's not a sea actually, it's a huge lake. The only way it loses water is by percolation and by evaporation. Now, as I said, this was a rift valley, because of which it was very low. And in fact, the Dead Sea is the lowest ever point on the surface of the earth. It lies about half a kilometer below sea level. So you can make out how low it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this, it has got different advantages. One thing is, there is so much of atmosphere between the land at the Dead Sea and the sunlight.
Okay.
So this intense, this incremental 10% of atmosphere brings in two important changes. One is, it reduces the amount of ultraviolet radiation that comes.
Okay.
And so, it is advised that, you know, sunbathing and a kind of therapy called heliotherapy.
Okay.
Is best done at the Dead Sea.
Oh, okay.
Because least UV radiation.
Mm-hmm.
It is known to cure psoriasis. Mm-hmm. Apart from that, there's a higher concentration of oxygen because of the heavier atmospheric pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And because nothing else lives here, there is no pollen, none of the known allergens in the air.
Okay.
So very good. So there is also a climatotherapy that is done at the Dead Sea. It is known to cure rhinosinusitis. Apart from this, as I said, there's a high salt concentration in the ocean, because mm-hmm. of which there is high minerals, because of which there is something called thalassotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
Thalassotherapy, which is water therapy, where they say that, you know, immersing yourself in that sea water for some time or making mud packs is known to help cure osteoarthritis. So there was a tourism industry boom. It's not as if it happened in the this boom happened in the 1930s, but it's not as if the Dead Sea gained importance only in the 1930s. Even before the 1930s, it has been important to the Greeks, for the Romans, for the Byzantium Empire. In fact, it is believed that the Egyptians used salt from the Dead Sea to preserve their mummies in Egypt,
okay,
in the pyramids. So it has been a very, very important, important geological structure in every sense, health-wise, in terms of affecting the local atmosphere there. The Dead Sea keeps the winters warmer than other places and the summers cooler because of water having a higher, you know, it absorbs heat. Water takes time to get heated up and therefore it also takes time to cool down. Therefore, in winter, the water is warm, mm-hmm, and a breeze that comes from the ocean is warm, which keeps you warm in winter. And in the summers, the water takes greater time to heat up, so there's a cool breeze blowing from the sea, which keeps the land cool. So all these effects are there. That is when, you know, again, you know, you can't label this as greed. But as we discussed, taking a decision without thinking about the consequences. On one hand, the source of water for Dead Sea was cut off. The river Jordan was extensively canalized and channelized into different areas in Jordan to help agricultural growth. So almost the influx of water reduced to 10% of its original into, mm-hmm, the Dead Sea. On the other hand, you know, potash, salts.
Right.
Different companies came up. There are
basically used in fertilizers and...
Yes, yes, right, yes. So the Palestine Potash Company was set up early in the 20th century. Then the Dead Sea Works Company, it's present even today, it's an Israeli company. The Arab Potash Company in Jordan. All these extract potash and what they do is they just drain out the water, evaporate the water to use what is left behind. And it is the world's largest manufacturer of potash-based chemicals,
mm-hmm,
this region. So as that increased, industrialization increased, today the Dead Sea has been reduced to 50% of its size. In fact, what was Dead Sea is today the northern Dead Sea and the southern Dead Sea.
Mm-hmm.
From 1050 square kilometers, it has got reduced to 600 square kilometers. And what is southern Dead Sea is not actually the sea.
Mm-hmm.
There is, if you zoom into Google Maps, it's amazing. You'll see one thin pipeline-like thing connecting the northern Dead Sea and the southern Dead Sea.
Okay.
It's almost as if a limb is severed from the body and it's hanging by a single sinew. And that is a canal, that is a pipeline that actually takes water from the northern Dead Sea, mm-hmm, into the southern Dead Sea so that it can be evaporated and made into salts and potash, and that is being done by the Dead Sea Works. So now, when from 1960s to about 2007, there has been a great reduction, and the reduction is so huge that people have started getting worried. It has started changes in the climate in that region. Salinity has gone up, and so many problems have arisen. In fact, now they are considering that they will make a canal from the Red Sea.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Sea is what lies between Africa and Asia.
Okay.
They want to make a canal from there to fill up the Dead Sea again. So you see, it has led to so many problems. And that's why I said we have to keep the past in the mind. See, it has taken 3 million years for a very unique structure called the Dead Sea to be formed. And in a span of 50 years, it has got ruined. So just as not thinking of the future can lead to ruin, not thinking of the past and how it has actually formed can also lead to ruin. You just cannot afford to ignore that.
Very true. You know, the only thing which comes to mind as you're describing that, especially, you know, not considering the past as well as the future, it just appears like poor investment, you know. When you're in a family, let's say that in our family, you just decide to buy a car. We won't think that I have 60 lakhs in the bank account. Let me buy a 60 lakh car. You know, that's not how we think. We say we have 60 lakhs. These are the other expenses which are there. So this much is how much I can afford for a car. But in the way we treat the environment, it's like, okay, I need this. The nature has it. So let me go and take it. So it is like there is a need. You just take what is available. Instead of thinking that how much can I take and, you know, that taking how sustainable it can be. It's almost like chopping up a goose that gives golden eggs.
Yeah.
You know, it's typically of that example. And that is where I think the beauty of what Swami says, especially on Ceiling on Desires, we had touched upon it last week. But the beauty of that is, you know, whenever Swami would talk about Ceiling on Desires, Swami would emphasize it's only ceiling on desires. I'm not telling you to give up desires. I'm not telling you to live the life of a yogi, a sannyasi, you know, go stay under a tree and not eat. Nothing like that. Swami said, yes, you have to take, but just like how you would, you would provide for your needs, at the same time thinking about the people around you, it's the same way we are supposed to treat these environmental issues. Don't, Swami, I mean, obviously Swami would say that nature has been created to feed the people that live on the planet. But at the same time, even as I'm taking, how much am I doing it in a sustainable manner? How much am I even accounting for the nature's ability to deal with it too?
Yes, as you said, it is meant to feed the humans, but not feed only the humans.
Right.
Just yesterday, you know, Professor G. Venkatraman, he was giving a talk to the students of the Anandpur campus of our university. And he put a PowerPoint slide which was very, very interesting. He said that the mansion of joy and peace and happiness has to be built in the following manner. The foundation should be dharma. The pillars should be knowledge and compassion. Knowledge without compassion is dangerous. Compassion without knowledge is ineffective and useless. So you need to have your mansion with the pillars of knowledge and compassion. And the roof is the ceiling on desires. And this is how we have to build the mansion, with ceiling on desires as the roof, knowledge and compassion as the pillars, and dharma as the base. So it and this mansion involves all the four. You know, the individual, society, nature, and God. So, if we are able to look at every problem in its entirety, we will be able to lead lives or do things such that such problems don't occur, or even if they have occurred, we find a way to solve it. I think that is the crux of our discussion today, as to, okay, this is what has happened. And you know, Dead Sea is just one example. This is a simple Google search will provide so many such lakes. One more is the Lake Urmia in northwest Iran, right, which has been reduced to 5% of its original size. You know, originally it was about 5,200 square kilometers. Today it is just 350 square kilometers. 102 beautiful islands were there. Now these are just oases of salt. Oases of salt. That is how it has happened. So there are so many such examples. But I think the crux should be, okay, this has happened. What now? Can we effect a change? Or is the situation so black and so bleak and dark that nothing can be done about it?
This is about the natural calamities which you've come across. But we have, you know, when you see that human impact on environment and the degradation of environment, I think one of the things which will come up in any search is that of oil slicks, or for that matter, even the Chernobyl, the nuclear-related disasters or
accidents,
and the chemical companies, as we spoke about Love Canal. You know, all this comes from, you come up with a technology or you come up with some chemical which is going to be useful, and you invent a synthetic process. But you're doing it without being patient enough to find out a means of handling all the issues that would pop up out of it. Because many of the disasters which have come from some of these chemical and, you know, industry-based accidents have come because without enough care being taken, without enough research being done into how to deal with the problems that could arise. Without doing that, you know, they've already gone into production. So now when you look at it, even talking about the Dead Sea and all that, and we spoke about how Swami said the proper study of mankind is man. In that sense, if you look at the kind of problems we have created in the environment, if we study that, we should be able to pinpoint some characteristics in human nature which Swami says that this is a mistake, you have to get rid of it. And one thing which really strikes me after going through all these examples is the lack of patience. You know, because we want instant results. You know, I put money somewhere, I want it to double the next year. Everywhere that the need for seeing instant results. You know, that is why if you look at it, somebody was talking about the rivers and, you know, some of these water bodies. They have this ability to self-regenerate. Okay, they have a period of time, even if you were to dump some very obnoxious things into them, they have a period of time where they can regenerate. Okay. But if you don't give them that time, that is when they start getting polluted. So most of the things which we do, we want to take water. It can be done if it is stretched over a period of time. If you know that I want only this much benefit from it right now, and only this much the river can afford or the lake can afford. And that calls for patience. You should say that I am ready to invest this much and take only this much. The desire to see instant results, the desire to instantly become rich, you know, what we see in day-to-day life, that when expressed by humanity as a whole, I think it ends up in problems such as these.
And as Swami says, because it is the individual that make up society and humanity as a whole, as each individual becomes more restless and impatient, so as a society as a whole, we become impatient and restless. And that is where all this happens. I am reminded of a Chinnakatha where Swami narrates of how a king one day is riding on his horse and he comes across an old man watering some saplings, which he seems to have planted along the way.
Okay.
And the king asks him, what you're doing? He says, I'm planting mango trees. And the king asks, why are you doing such a foolish thing? So the man asks, why do you consider it foolish? Don't you see that the mangoes will take at least another 10 years to form? It's before 10 years, you can't expect any fruit. And old man, it is really amazing that you're optimistic that you will be living for another 10 years. I admire your optimism. Says, King, I don't think that I will live for 10 more years. It is not any optimism. I don't think I will be alive to eat any of these mangoes. Then why are you planting them? Says, oh my king, is it true that all the mangoes that I have eaten in my life are from trees which I have planted? No. It is somebody else's effort that I have reaped the fruit. So when he's, you know, a very important point he brings out here, he says, when I'm planting trees, it's not as if I'm serving the future generation. It is just repayment for a loan that I've already taken. See, as when we are babies, when we eat the food that society has produced, when we enjoy the security and protection that society gives, we are already indebted to society, we are already indebted to nature. It's not as if when I do something for society or when I do something for nature, it's great. It's just a part of the debt that I am repaying. This attitude of the old man, if we can bring into ourselves, it'll help a lot. The attitude that I'm not doing any service to society or service to nature, I'm just repaying a huge debt that I've already taken onto my head. And because society and nature especially is very compassionate, I think the compassion we see reduces. Maximum compassion is God, next is nature, next is society, least is the individual.
True.
Because the individual may be intolerant, society is little tolerant. Nature is even more tolerant, God is the maximum intolerance. So, in that sense, society and nature are very tolerant, even if we don't repay the debt in full. See, to God we can never repay the debt completely. That's what we feel, what Swami has done for us in life, we will never be able to repay in our lifetime or lifetimes. Similarly, nature and society too is quite forgiving, but we should not take that for granted and do our little bit in repaying the huge debt and loan that we have taken.
Even as you're telling that Chinnakatha, which Swami says about mangoes and the old man planting a mango tree, you know, I think last week we were in a question and answer session which was being handled by Professor Anil Kumar, where one person came up and asked this question. He very graphically and in a detailed manner gave the chronology of the Satyuga, the Dwapara Yuga and the Treta Yuga. He said that lasted 20,000 years, this was supposed to be 5,000 years. And at the end of it, he said, sir, can you tell us how long the Kali Yuga will last? And I know the beautiful answer which Anil Kumar sir gave. We were all wondering, you know, what would you tell? Because it's such a theoretical and fact-seeking question it was. It was not a, you know, question which you could infer Swami's message and give an answer.
And I don't think anybody can answer with confidence other than
right,
Swami.
Right, exactly. And the answer which Anil Kumar sir gave was brilliant. He said, don't worry, you will not last that long. And you know, he went on to say that, see, we've been thrown into a situation and we've been lucky to find the master and his words. Our duty is to follow his words as much as possible. when you look at it in this, in the light of what we're discussing right now, will we be able to set right all this? Will the Dead Sea go back to its, you know, 10,000 kilometers of whatever the size? Will the other sea, which we spoke about, Aran Sea, will it be restored? We don't know. It might not happen in our lifetime. It may never happen in our lifetime. But our situation is to do responsible action now, do what is right now, and within our capacity, whatever is done, we have to do. I think that's the thing. And even as you spoke about that old man who is thinking about the future generations, I think it is a perfect time for us to maybe even add a little bit of positivity to what situation we're seeing. But shall we do that after a short break?
Definitely, Prem. After this little break, we'll be back. Don't go away, listeners, because the, if I can say so, the sad part of the presentation is over. The happy and cheerful portions are about to come.
Namah Parvati Pataye Har Har.
Namah Parvati Pataye Har Har.
Har Har Shankar Mahadeva. Har Shankar Mahadeva. Shiva, 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 Shiva,
Shiva,
Shiva, Shiva, Shiva, Shiva, Shiva, Shiva, Har Shankar Mahadeva.
Har 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 Mahadeva.
Har 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 Mahadeva. Shiva, Shiva, Sada Shiva. Mahadeva, Sada Shiva. Sada Shiva, Mahadeva. Har 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 Mahadeva.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Hope you enjoyed that energetic and wonderful rendering of that beautiful bhajan, Nama Parvati Pataye Hara Hara. It's very, very relevant to the discussion we are having now because it's a bhajan in praise of Parvati and Parvati Pate, that is Shiva. In our context, as Swami has said, Parvati represents Prakriti or nature and Shiva is the Paramatma, God. So this bhajan speaks about seeing God in nature and seeing nature as part of God. That is what we are discussing also. So hope you enjoyed and hope you followed and sang along just as we did in the studio over here. We will take you to some successful examples of how people who are able to have this kind of a holistic vision of the individual, society, nature and God are able to in fact achieve miracles with perseverance and patience.
You know, the question which after we've spoken about so much and all that, and the question as we said earlier also and in today's show, is what can I do? What can an individual do? You know, the problem is caused in a global scale. What can an individual do? The story of this person whom we're going to narrate today is brilliant. You know, what a man's achievement, what a man's determination can achieve. And is about a very simple man in Kerala. His name was Abdul Karim. He's still there. You know, this person, like any other, many of these youngsters in Kerala, he goes to Bombay, he works in a dockyard, he comes back. And then that was the time when you had this Middle East boom in southern India, where a lot of people were going to the Middle East, Dubai and UAE to work.
Are you speaking of the 1990s? Possibly?
Yes, it must be the 70s actually. Oh, that's okay. When it started okay. In states like Kerala. After the construction and things started, I think the engineers started moving towards the Middle East. But this was the time when a lot of laborers and, you know, some kind of odd jobs, you could go and work there. So this was sometime in the 70s. So he comes back from Bombay. He sets up a small agency, which kind of facilitates those who wish to go abroad and all that kind of stuff. But imagine all this time, what is the dream he was living with?
What?
Individuals like him dream of building houses.
Exactly. Or, when you asked like that, I was wondering.
Yeah, you dream of building a house or you dream of buying a car. His dream was to build a forest.
Oh.
He said, I want to build a forest. Imagine that. And so this man, Abdul Karim, you know, he has by then saved a bit of money. He just goes and buys 5 acres of absolutely barren rock-filled land. Absolutely no fertility, nothing growing there, not even shrubs and bushes. That kind of land he buys, 5 acres, and he buys for a princely sum of 3,750. And that's what he says, because it was not worth even a penny, because nothing was growing there, and it was quite cut off from the city for it to be of any other use. So he goes and buys this land. And then he goes to the forest department and he asks them for about 100 saplings, which they very gladly give him. And they ask him, where are you going to plant all this? So he kind of indicates the land which he has bought. And they all start laughing at him. You have any idea where you're thinking of planting these things? Because there's no water there and nothing grows there. The water is not, the soil is not fertile. So he says, no, I'm just going to try my luck. So he goes and plants all these in the crevices of some of these rocks or between two rocks. That's how he starts. And he says 100 saplings planted. In a matter of few days, almost 99 of them dry out. Okay, that's how bad that land is. So he goes to the agriculture society and again he buys 100 saplings. I think the forest department, I'm sorry. That was a time when there was an initiative the government was doing, encouraging people to grow forests, grow trees.
If I can interrupt you here, right. Prem, in fact, this initiative continues even today. An year ago, I remember a group of volunteers had come here from Trinidad, and they wanted to do some gram seva.
Okay.
So they had come along with 3 resources, time, energy, and money.
Okay.
So they wanted to, they did a veterinary camp in a nearby village. A village that is not covered by the Sri Satya Sai Gram Seva. They did a veterinary camp and they did a distribution of provisions. They did some cleanliness drive. One innovative initiative that they took up based on a suggestion given by an alumnus who is residing in Puttaparthi was planting of saplings. The idea was do something for immediate relief, which is giving them provisions for the next 2-3 months.
Or blankets or something like that, which they could use.
Immediately they'll use. Do something for a mid-term relief. That is like veterinary camp, medical camp. So you help them in their whatever problems, which will give a middle-term relief. And for the long-term, he said, allow them to plant trees like coconut and teak wood. See, these might not be useful immediately, but 20 years down the line, that whole region will get transformed. Now, why I told all this was, at that time when we had to procure these saplings, we got it at a very good concessional rate from the forest department.
Okay.
The government in India, at least I know of it, has definitely set up an institution where you can purchase these kind of saplings which are suited to different regions in India, and they will give it at a very concessional rate if you are ready to take and plant them.
Right. So that exactly is the scheme which this person kind of utilized. And this was way back in 1977. Hmm. Okay. So the first year, two sets all dried up. And then he realizes that maybe if he can take some plants which are a little more, you know, rather than saplings, take plants which have a little more advanced in their growth. Maybe that would help. So he tries that, and finally that kind of seems to work. But imagine there's no water around. So he brings water on his motorbike on pots from a well which is 2 kilometers away.
Hmm.
And imagine this man driving up and down 2 kilometers just to water those plants which he has planted there. And he does this for first 2 years, hardly anything grows. And by the third year, he finds that some of those plants begin to show some hope. Okay, they're starting to grow, and they even survive the summer. So that, he says, is a good sign. This was in 5 acres of land. And sometime in 1982, he again pitches all the money he has and buys 27 acres of land, of such land. Okay, arid, no fertility, and no water. And now he's got 32 acres of land. And he starts year after year putting all this, and everybody's laughing at him. You know, it's such a stupid thing to do, that's what they say. But it took about 5 years when suddenly these things started growing. And the first sign was, he says that he had got a well dug up in that place, which kind of would get filled up whenever there is rain. And if your water table is good enough, it might even last the summer. So he found that with years that he could manage a well which had about 500 liters of water in peak summer.
Hmm.
But after he started all these plantations, any idea how that capacity of that well grew? From 500, it went
about
up to
3,000?
10,000 liters.
Oh my God.
In peak summer.
Hmm.
And it became a perennial well. Even in the worst of summers, it could stand. And that was in 5 years, imagine. And slowly he started, and all these things started growing, and no chemicals whatsoever. No manure, no fertilizer.
He said, chemical ones.
Right. He said, all that I gave was only water. And when I say no manure, he did not even do any artificial manuring. He did not even take manure and put.
Oh, not even cow dung.
No. He did not do any manuring. He said, I did not prune any of the trees. I did not chop any of the bushes. And I did not even clear out the leaves which would fall. He said, I just wanted nature to take its course. And all that I provided was my determination and water.
Hmm.
And even that water, of course, understandably, after some time, that was also not necessary. Because not only was that well replenishing by itself, he started getting people from around the, you know, those villages who were living in the fringe of that forest. They found that even their wells were becoming perennial.
Hmm.
They had wells which would, you know, it was understood that during summers you would not have water there, but even those wells started filling up. And he found that this particular 32 acres of land which he had bought and he had toiled with had kind of become like a sponge which was absorbing all the rainwater and was replenishing the water table.
Wow.
Okay, and added to that, now next what he did, he started making water holes to attract birds. And he was very smart, you know, it was not just like a nature loving person. He said, I wanted to attract birds because I wanted to give nature a natural process of propagation of all these plantations. So automatically new variety of species of plants started growing because of their, you know, their droppings, and that became manure and all that. And he said, eventually the water which these wells started holding, when tested, they were very, very pure, mineralized herbal water.
Wow.
Because of, you know, the plantation and all that. And imagine one man pitching all his money into it, and he has brought out that 27 acres of, in fact, he's known as the man who built a forest now.
Wow.
What you can achieve when you chase a dream. And in fact, I think in 2005 or something, the Indian Oil Corporation, they gave him a petrol bunk, a gas station. They said, you run this, and whatever money you have, you can continue with your work. You don't have to, you know, let not any financial strain come and stop you now.
Wow.
And, you know, it's such a brilliant thing, that one change which you can bring in, you know. And he makes a statement, I just want to make a quote of what he says. He says, much impatience, discontent and violence is due to the lack of an opportunity to reconnect with our roots. If you are in tune with nature, you will come to love the world and humanity. And he's just a very humble person. And in fact, now in studies of afforestation and all that, they call this the Karim model. It's actually the natural model. He's not done anything. It's absolutely the natural model. They call it the Karim model. He says people from Germany, Estonia and, you know, Latin America come to study the way he has built this thing. And even now he says that you can understand if you have 32 acres of good, nice vegetation, so many resort owners want to come and buy that land and set up resorts. He says, no, that's not the idea at all. I can at best give it for people to do research. Nothing more than that. And he says, this is my child. He's got, of course, 5 or 7 children. But he says, this is my child. Every tree over here is my child. You know, that is what, if an individual, I don't think all of us can become something like this person. But the change which is starting from even an individual can have such a huge impact. That's what this shows, isn't it?
This inspiring story actually provokes two thoughts. Both what Swami says. The first thing is, take one step towards me, I'll take 100 towards you. It appears that this holds good not only for God, but also to nature. The way nature responded to his love and commitment is amazing. Because
before we go ahead, just one thing which he said. He says the greatest achievement in all this, and see the foresight of the man, he says, not the honors which the state government gave him, of course the Indian Oil Corporation's recognition, he's got so many international awards. He said, what made me feel most happy was when his story became part of class 6 book.
Oh.
It became a part of syllabus. He said, because this is what I want to pass on. You know, this belief which I had in nature and our ability to regenerate, I am so happy that it is getting passed on to the next generation.
Fantastic. That is really superb. Nothing else to add to the story. Nature gives back. Society also gives back if we are able to take that one step towards it. The other thing is what we had highlighted before, you know, that let us live with the attitude that whatever we have is actually a loan from nature, from society, which we have to repay. See, this person, it's amazing that he wanted to build a forest. But he could have as well picked up a good land, right?
Right.
Unless
I mean,
you
if it was just interest in gardening.
You could have picked up a nice fertile piece of land and done gardening. But see, it is like, suppose you have taken a loan of 1 lakh rupees. You will think twice before taking another loan, right? Of 10,000 rupees. You want to pay back this 1 lakh rupee loan. And then only, if needed, you will take another loan. Otherwise, you want to live loan free. That will be your attitude. That attitude is seen here. That is why he didn't want to pick any more additional favors from nature. He didn't want to. He took, that's why, as a loan repayment.
Right.
He never thought, what can the land do for me? This is a useless land, it can't do anything for me. He always thought of what I can do for the land, because he felt like he's indebted to nature. And, you know, brings to mind what Winston Churchill said, that think not of what the nation can do for you, think what you can do for the nation. Similarly, think not of what nature can do for you, think what you can do for nature. And as his story pans out, we see clearly that when done with that attitude, you're definitely going to end up as a winner.
Very
because
true.
How much ever you try, whatever you give good to nature, it gets thrown back to you 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times. And the same happens even when we do bad. Nature is forgiving up to a limit. But after that limit, nature seems to hit back just to restore the balance. And if we humans become collateral damage there, it's no use crying and blaming nature. I think it's a very, very inspiring story which inspires us and teaches us the need for individual action, determination, patience and the attitude that whatever we have in life is actually a loan, is actually a debt that we should spend our life repaying.
And I think Venkatraman sir would often quote this, you know, in the words of Mahatma Gandhi. He said, to treat everything with the attitude of trusteeship. It has been entrusted to me and it is my duty to pass it on. If not made better, at least in the state in which it was given to me. And that's the important thing, you know, and you were talking about intention, when the intentions are pure. And we also spoke about how intelligence is also important. Because many of the natural disasters which we see actually may have even started with a good intention of, you know, good intention of feeding a large population of people who are poor, or getting water to a large population. You might have ended up redirecting a river, and you know, we have so many issues with dams coming up right now.
See, that is why, Prem, it is said the two pillars are compassion and knowledge.
Absolutely.
While compassion determines our intention, knowledge is the intelligence. One without the other is useless. So if you have only knowledge without the good intention, it's dangerous. You have good intention without the knowledge, it can again be dangerous, as you were speaking.
Very true. In fact, many times when I think of a situation like this, what occurs to me is this, when you do anything like this, your attitude should be like that of a goldsmith. You know, a goldsmith throws gold into the raw or ore into the fire, but all the time he's seeing to note when is the time to pull it out. I think any change like this you make to nature, you have to constantly keep seeing that, yes, the intention was good, but is the intention's end being met? At any time, if it is not being met, you should be able to pull back and change the course, and you know, ensure that intention is being fulfilled.
You mentioned Professor G.V. and that actually reminded me of two beautiful quotes.
Mm-hmm.
Both are, one is by a spiritual American spiritual teacher, the other is by a theoretical physicist. And it takes us back to the idea that we have to see everything as part of the whole.
Okay.
There's only one whole. You know, we can't divide the earth on basis of countries or castes or creed. We have to see it as whole. There is this famous book called The Dancing Woolly Masters, written by this US spiritual teacher. And in that there is a detailed study of the evolution of physics.
Okay.
And I quote from that book, "The philosophical implication of quantum mechanics is that all things in our universe, including us, that appear to exist independently are actually parts of one all-encompassing organic pattern, and that no parts of that pattern are ever really separate from it or from each other." In short, the physical world, according to quantum mechanics, is not a structure built out of independently existing, unanalyzable entities, but rather a web of relationships as a whole. Now, if those words appeared as too high-flown, here are some more high-flown words, but I will read it out slowly. If we are able to appreciate it, we will realize that that is where even science is headed to. This is by Geoffrey Chu. Geoffrey Chu, a US theoretical physicist, he's still alive.
Okay.
And he says, "Your electrons and mine are only approximately distinguishable. In denying objective reality that Einstein vehemently stood by, quantum mechanics denies absolute status to your individuality. The only individual that exists in the universe is the universe." You know, it just shows that science is heading, the advances in science is heading to viewing the entire universe as one organism and not as a cluster of galaxies, which are clusters of stars, which are clusters of planets and other bodies on which there are different species. Each species is independent fighting. It's not speaking about unity of all organisms in a species. It's not enough if we unite as all humans together. It speaks of unity not only across species. It's not enough if all the life forms unite together. It speaks of unity across everything. Because the only one being that exists in the universe is the universe itself.
Very true. You know, that is the beauty when we said that spirituality is not something which is impractical. You can see that even those who study elemental physics are coming to that understanding. And even biologists and chemists, in fact, there's a very famous, it's called the Gaia hypothesis. And if I've got the name right, I think it's by a chemist by name James Lovelock. He came up with his theory, very similar to what you said. Of course, it's a little smaller version of that, you could say.
Somehow all your examples today are related to love. Because your
very
Prem,
true.
Is it?
Yeah, we started with William Love, who built the Love Canal.
Yourself love. Prem means love.
Very true, okay. Alright then. So what this scientist Lovelock, he says is that, you know, the earth is one single organism. Just like how you are an organism and every cell of your body is just a part of your being, He says the earth is a breathing living organism and each one of us is nothing more than just, you know, one cell or one tissue in it. And if you were to look at the earth as such and treat all the problems and the issues relating to the environment like that, our solutions will be more sensible in the sense. Because, you know, as you see, these are not people who are giving you romantic ideas of what creation or nature is. The more you study it, this is the idea which keeps hitting at you. And why not look at problems and look for solutions for problems with this idea in mind?
In fact, the way you describe, if you see, science is definitely headed towards corroborating the Vedantic truth that underlying the seen and experienced world,
very true,
there is a mysterious substratum that unifies.
You know that it was a brilliant statement what he says, the only thing which can claim individuality is the universe itself, not you and me.
So, therefore, I think the first lesson that we can take from all this is something that we have to do deep within. That is, start viewing everything as part of the whole. Now, that is something that we can inculcate. You may ask now that, how does this help in rejuvenating the Red Sea? Or, I mean, the Dead Sea or the Aral Sea?
It might as well be the Red Sea very soon, if you don't watch out.
Exactly. So, you might ask, how does this help? But I think that is where we bring in that Bhagavad Gita practice of not worrying about the results, but concentrating on our efforts. And even as I say this, there is one important distinction that we have to make.
Mm-hmm.
That is, there is a difference between not worrying about the results vis-a-vis not bothered about the consequences.
Very true. In fact, that is a confusion which people would say, that when you say that you do it thinking about the future and the future generations, you have to worry about their concern. But people would say that why you always are told to live in the present, you're told to act without thinking about the future. In fact, that is a mistake. You're not asked to act without worrying or thinking about the consequences. You're asked to act without having an eye on the result of the action.
Without any expectation.
Right, without any expectation. Do what is right, because that's what Swami would say. The entire essence of Bhagavad Gita is do your dharma. And what it says is do your dharma without having an eye on the reaction to that. So live your life in an eco-friendly manner, if you could put it that way, without worrying about what's going to happen to the Aral Sea or the Dead Sea.
Exactly. So to speak of it in a concise manner, one must have detachment, but should not confuse detachment with indifference.
Indifference. Very true. Very true. And not worry about the results of your action in the sense of what you're expecting from it, but definitely worry about the consequence, because that becomes part of your dharma, that becomes part of how you do the action itself.
For example, if we take the example of Mr. Karim,
mm-hmm.
whom you said who built the forest, detachment would mean he will build the forest irrespective of people writing about him, irrespective of whether Hindustan Petroleum or Bharat Petroleum, whoever it is, gives him a petrol bunk, irrespective of whether his name will come in a chapter in a textbook. But at the same time, he, as you said, he will intelligently think of how to build bird pools so birds will come, so that there is an expansion in
very true, speciation
of trees. So you definitely have to think about the consequences of your action, but you should not be obsessed with expectation and result and get disappointed if it doesn't happen in that manner. So there is a actually it's not a fine line distinction, it's a very clear distinction, only that the terms get confusing. When you say don't think about the future, it doesn't mean you should be indifferent, it just means that you should not get overburdened with expectations and the result that comes from it. You definitely cannot be indifferent, you have to be involved but not attached.
And also talking about the impact of the individual on the whole, going back to what these scientists are coming to tell now, I think what is the truth is definitely much more than what meets our eye. And if I can change my lifestyle here, what meets my eye is it makes no difference to even the community, forget the country or the world. But who knows, you never know if you are so connected. And as an individual, as in a part of that whole, we are making a change, you never know what is the impact it's going to make on the whole itself.
See, again, let's go back to that same Karim example. Would he ever have dreamt that he's going to make such a big impact?
He's going to replenish the water in the wells of the villages nearby. Even that much he wouldn't have thought.
Exactly.
But as he says that now people from Germany want to come and study it, definitely it's growing. His idea is growing. The the faith that you can trust nature to build something like this on its own, if you just give it the right environment, I think that faith is growing now. People have that ability to believe in that.
In fact, Prem, if we can just rewind a little bit and think of why the world is how it is today. If we say that there is rampant greed, rampant selfishness, you know, it didn't begin with a bang. It actually started in the same manner, where a single person thought that, you know, suppose there is no theft in a village. In fact, there is a village called Shani Shingnapur in Maharashtra where none of the homes are locked because it's, because they feel that no theft takes place. That is more because of fear of the god Shani rather than out of love. But there possibly was a time when nobody used to lock because nobody would take others, what belongs to others. But then possibly one person got this idea thinking, you know, if I take, I'm going to get immensely benefited and it's not much of a difference to society. Let me indulge in this robbery or let me indulge in thieving. Let me indulge, whatever negative evil that we think of indulging, when we actually think of indulging, we don't do it because we want to demoralize and demolish the world. We do it, in fact, because we feel that it is going to benefit me and it won't do much harm for anybody else.
Right.
But today we have seen that those little actions, how much big harm it has done. So why don't we use that as an inspiration to start a positive cycle? Just like we felt that these little things of greed and selfishness on my part will not have much impact, and today we see, oh my God, no. Even little individuals having greed and selfishness, as Mahatma Gandhi said, there is enough on earth for every man's need, but not a single man's greed. If a single man's greed can bring about such a negative cycle, a single man's selflessness and a single man's love can definitely bring about a positive cycle. So I think that is how we should view it.
And very true, and that is where the idea of innovation actually comes in handy. One of the neuroscientists, you know, he says that, you have any idea how many centuries it would have taken for a sheep which lives high up in the mountains to develop that, fur outer cover which it has? I mean, the wool which we take from the sheep.
Evolution.
Evolution is such a slow process. Darwinian theory says that, you know, it happens over centuries sometimes.
But thousands of years.
Right, but what man does, the same man who lives in the same condition, he does not have to wait till he evolves that kind of a wool on his own skin. He can take the wool from the sheep when it does not need it. Now that's the beauty. The summertime, actually, the sheep can do without it. Takes it when the sheep does not need it and makes for himself something which he can use during the winter. And that is what innovation can do. You don't have to wait for evolution. In fact, that is something which is happening now. You know, that positive change, this need for greener technologies, need for sustainable changes, and you can see that happening in very, very big levels. In fact, I was just Googling and trying to find out the top five green initiatives or companies which have gone green. In fact, some of the big companies in the Western countries like Intel, like Google, they are trying to shift completely to renewable sources of energy. In fact, I think some of the banks have managed to go 100% on renewable sources of energy, like Gobar Gas and solar energy. So they are not taking anything from fossil fuel energy. Completely they are running on renewable sources. This wouldn't have been possible sometime back. Now they find that, yes, we need to account for this. We need to do something about the situation we have created. Once you have acknowledged that and you have said that we have to do, innovation just takes its place. You know, that's what needs to be done. It's just that we have not accounted for all these in our innovation sometime back.
You know, Swami would often say that EHV, education in human values, is actually 3HV.
Right.
The unity of the 3 H's. The 3 H being head, heart and hands. And there is this beautiful combination that we can use. The heart has compassion. And the compassion in the heart leads to, you know, a kind of a passion in the belly.
Right.
A passion to work to change. Whether we take Kareem's example or we take the example of green companies, it should begin with compassion in the heart, the right attitude, the basis, which leads to passion in the belly, and that passion in the belly leads to an innovation. It is that passion that brings about innovation. It is that passion actually that brought about the innovation of taking wool from the sheep and making sweaters also. Any kind of innovation, if it follows this route, then we will have a sustainable earth model. If we see Swami's projects, See, that is the thing. It always has to have a firm grounding and basis. Every of his project, be it Gram Seva, the Orissa water, the Orissa housing project, or the water project, everything starts with compassion in the heart. Swami read one newspaper article that a mother had poisoned her children. And he said, with tears in his eyes, Swami cried out. We all remember that day when he cried out and said, in this land of Bharat that is blessed with plenty, how can a mother commit suicide? And you know, you could see that rivers of compassion were flowing from Swami's eyes and Swami's heart. That compassion steeled itself into a resolve, into a passion in his belly. You know, he said, no, nobody. And that resulted in the innovative Gram Seva. You know, on the face of it, it appears as if people are going once a year and giving food and clothes. But we, all of us have experienced it, and we have seen this model being propagated across the world now, where when you go and treat somebody with love and give food, it's not the monetary worth of that food and clothes that matter. It is about giving hope and giving love, telling people that you are wanted. You know, that in itself fires people with the will to live, the hope to live.
That's the beauty of the Gram Seva model, if you're talking about that. You know, as you said, if you look at it just as what is done on the ground, yeah, you take food, one person gets one packet of prasadam once a year. What difference is that going to make? But see Swami's foresight in this whole model. There is a situation in the society, and he did not say how to go. Of course, immediacy in action was also there. Swami built, got some Dinajano Dharana Patakams built, where orphanages, where children will be taken care of. But see Swami's foresight, he found that the problem is not actually those people not able to find the means to earn their food. It's because increasingly the educated class is actually becoming indifferent to some of these things. So Swami said, I have a university. Let me sensitize these boys, because these boys are going to become part of that society of educated people in the future. So actually Swami's vision was absolutely, you know, as you said, in the largest sense. In fact, what Swami did through Gram Seva is much more of sensitization of this community of students than actually reaching out to those people. Because now these boys, when they go out, every time they waste food, they will think of that village they visited. Every time they splurge on their luxuries, they will think of the houses they went into to give that prasadam which Swami gave. You know, that is the innovation which is backed by compassion, which we saw in Swami's projects. And in fact, you were talking about, the Godavari project and the kind of beautiful results that had.
It is a mind-boggling, Prem. You know, in India, for example, they found recent survey 2010 or something, they found that out of 600 districts that the different states have been divided into, 200 of them suffer from the Naxalite problem. The Naxal Bhari movement is a movement, a grassroots movement,
right,
which was started by people becoming, you know, violent because their basic needs of food, clothing and shelter were not being met. And there was no way they could take it, so they resorted to violence to snatch it from a society that is depriving them of these basic needs. And you know, the Godavari districts, East and West Godavari districts in Andhra Pradesh were not exempt from this. The Naxalite movement was present there also. Ever since Swami's Godavari project, the drinking water project, with the water, see, it was not as if it lacked water. There, the Godavari is a magnificent river, and this is a region that gets enough rain. But since it's hilly, all the water flows down, and the people, mostly the tribal people, the poor people, the neglected people, the uneducated ones, they have to walk miles down the hill to fetch water. Miles you have to walk. And there was no way. So Swami, what he did was, he just piped that water and built a free water project, taking water to their doorsteps.
Their own water was taken to their doorstep. Actually, you know, that was the beauty of the thing. It really, when you look at it now, you think, how did the government ever miss that?
Exactly. Right? Now, it's not that you're taking from somewhere else.
Right.
It's their own and giving it to them. And as it went to their doorstep, what happened was, they began to love and trust these people in blue scarves and yellow scarves, these men and women, who are messengers from someone who has given them water. They started listening to them. And that is when, you know, they started education. They started Bal Vikas. They started cleanliness drive. Taught them hygiene. Primary medical facilities. In fact, today, in the successful SSS VIP program, the Sri Satya Sai Village Integrated Program, there are people from the same villages. You know, just like what their own water was given to them, their own people have become primary medical care facilitators, primary school teachers, and their standard of living, standard of life has improved. Better farming methods are being taught. They used to do a kind of farming, I forget the name, it's called podu cultivation, yes. Mm-hmm. Where they just burn a part of the forest, grow till the thing has got nutrition,
and move
then
on.
They shift over, move on.
Right.
So the forest gets destroyed, and forest land is government land, there is conflict, all this happens. Everything has got solved, and the most amazing thing is the Naxalite movement is almost dead in these districts because people are happy. Now, if you, on the, 5 to 6 years back, if you had asked, how do you end this Naxalite problem and you say provide drinking water, it looks so distant.
You'll only think about better policing and, you know, better increasing the security in these regions.
More training, commandos. Who would have thought that giving drinking water can actually end a Naxalite problem? See, that is how connected all things are. In the same way, that is why we are focusing on our attitude and the basics. Because if the basics are set right, this is the root of the problem. If the roots are taken care of, the fruits are bound to be sweet and juicy.
I think the same thing about even the Anantapur Water Project. Maybe a couple of years back, Venkatraman sir wrote a brilliant article about the impact of that water project, which tends to get missed. Because he wrote about the project, looking back at it, about 10 years after it was done. Hmm. Okay, and I think 2012 he had written, and 92 is it? I'm sorry, 96?
The water project?
Right, water project
91.
Was 91, right. Hmm. So it's about 10 years down the line, what was the impact it had?
I'm sorry, 95.
So in that he reads about, he actually has got collected data about the fall in fluoride content in the water, which was obvious because the water was coming from elsewhere. And the fall in cases relating to, you know, osteoporosis and the bone related and the dental problems which come. And all these have fallen drastically and people have actually not realized that this has happened.
A lifestyle improvement.
Lifestyle improvement, and it's really happened in this decade, in this two decades of the water project. And automatically, imagine your generation becomes healthier, your youth are healthier.
They can work harder.
You work harder, production
better,
goes up.
Spend less on their health. It results in so much and actually brings about economic prosperity. Who would have thought that just giving drinking water will bring economic prosperity? See, that is how far reaching, that is the beauty of the chaos theory, that is the beauty of the butterfly effect, which says that a butterfly flapping its wing in Philippines can cause a tornado in America or something like that. Now that can be a positive butterfly as well as a negative butterfly. So, till now we are suffering because of the flapping of the wings of negative butterflies. Can we start positive butterflies? You know, the idea itself is so exciting that I get butterflies in my stomach now.
Very true. And it all starts in the individual level. It all starts in, and I think it's beautiful, the other point which you were just telling me in the break about, yes, I cannot do anything now, but what is the guarantee I will not be able to do anything in the future? So if I have to do in the future, I have to be prepared now, right?
Exactly.
The preparation starts now.
You can't say that let me become the... I was watching a serial, you know,
okay.
A serial that is coming on the television.
Mm-hmm.
In that there is this person who wants to capture and defeat another king he wants to win over. So there is this lady who comes and asks him, now what are your plans for solving this problem that exists in this kingdom, solving that different problem that exists? He says, no, why should I plan that? That kingdom doesn't belong to me. Says, but you're planning to conquer that. He says, first let me win it, then let us see. See, the problem is even in our elections, modern day leaders, that is what happens. See, let us first come to power and win, then we will see. Recently there was a panchayat elections or something 1 year back. So the, those candidates had come home seeking votes. So when I asked both of them, what are your plans? First, they say, sir, first let us come to power, then we'll do, you don't worry. So nobody has an idea. So when they don't have an idea now, you see 1 year down the line, I don't know if much improvement or change has happened in Puttaparthi, or I don't know if that king wins the battle and conquers that kingdom, whether he'll be able to transform the kingdom. It is like Swami saying that in your last moments of death, if you think of God, you will be liberated. But in order to think of God in the last moment, at the point of time of your death, you have to think of God throughout your life. So in the same manner, Today I might not be able to do anything. Tomorrow I might be the CEO of Google. I might be the CEO of PepsiCo. I might be whatever. I might be the president of a country. I might be the prime minister of a chief minister of a state. Whatever. At that point in time, I can't inculcate. So who knows? Today it looks like it's not going to make much of a difference. But who knows what God has in store for us, plans for us. So when God focuses the focus light on us and gives us that power, authority or influence, that time let us not be found wanting.
And that kind of a change and that kind of attitude should be brought in even now. And that's why I mentioned that Abdul Karim saying that his greatest achievement after all this was to find a place in that 6th standard book. Because he felt that this innovation and this kind of thinking has to be passed on. And that can be done at every home. At every dining table it can be inculcated.
And that another beautiful point from the same Karim example is, he wants to spread the awareness, of course. But when you want to spread awareness, it's not enough if it is done only by word. It has to be done first by action. It has to be done by action. That is what Karim did. Before getting into the textbooks, he actually did the action. You know, I was reminded of an article that appeared of a bunch of boys in Bangalore, where they, not bunch of boys, bunch of youth, it is both boys and girls together, they just go to a very dirty spot, just clean it up, paint it, do it up. It doesn't cost much for them. But they put in their labor of love, do it and clean, and then just post on social media before and after.
Okay.
In fact, that has inspired many other people to do the same. At the same time, the people whose area has got positively affected, they try to at least increase the area where it is clean and try not to litter that same thing, same place again. And even if it gets littered, here again this group has inculcated that Bhagavad Gita message of don't bother about the results. They go and do it again because people may possibly litter it once or twice or thrice more. But after some time, it's going to definitely catch on. Just as the littering habit catches on, the de-littering and cleaning up habit also will catch on.
And that's the beauty of individual effort itself. Because it can, as you said, you know, it can very well be a drop which gathers and becomes a current, a flow of water. And that's the beauty. And that is why you can never negate the importance of individual action. And we might have spoken of global crisis and global problems, but for everything, the beginning starts from the individual. And if you look at it, I don't know about the atheists. We all believe that there is one all-powerful God, and we know that we see him as our beloved Swami. He can change everything in a trice, and he actually sees only the intention. He does not see what you have achieved or what you can do.
The effort and intention.
Who knows, he might just reset everything to the beautiful planet which he gave to us. And that is why it all lies in our hand. It all lies in our effort. It all lies in our individual effort. And that's why, even though technically, scientifically speaking, you cannot do anything about, the forest cover in the Amazon going down or lakes and rivers drying up. But I think that individual intention can make a lot of difference.
Dear listeners, the time in our studio is 1:58. It's almost time to complete. The Golden Quadrilateral has been a thought-provoking discussion for both Prem and myself. And what we realize is our intention and efforts are most important. And these intentions and efforts must be directed towards seeing it as a quadrilateral rather than just four discrete points. So that is the take-home message from this discussion, where we have to look at it as a complete whole, look as the entire universe as one being, and allow this thought, allow this idea, allow this feeling to course through every action, every thought, every word that we carry out, every decision that we take. And that would be the best way we will be contributing towards our own spiritual progress towards God, because God is constituted by society and nature also. We cannot achieve God by separating society and nature, and we cannot do any benefit to society or nature by separating God.
So dear listeners, we'll conclude our discussion with this, but let the thought process continue, because what we can do in our homes, what we can do in our workplaces, that needs to go on, because whatever we do now, it is adding a little bit to the efforts in the global scale. So let this not be something which we do outside our life of devotion, outside our life of spirituality. Our whole idea was to make it clear that whatever is done with the right intention is being offered to Swami, and it definitely is not out of what the spiritual offerings that you make to Bhagwan. With that thought, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with Arvind, we offer our humble effort at Swami's lotus feet. We're going to leave you with a beautiful prayer song recorded in our studios. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu with his program, Love to Love.
Devotion to thee.